KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. In 1963, one of the most controversial books of the 20th century was published. Eichmann in Jerusalem presented Adolf Eichmann not as a sociopath, but as an ordinary person who simply believed his actions were normal. The author of this book, political theorist Hannah Arendt, refers to this theory as the banality of evil. Arendt was a Jew who fled Germany in the early 1930s. Yale professor Shayla Ben-Habib offers an overview of the controversy surrounding Arendt's book and what lessons it can teach us about humanity. Ben-Habib spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on October 24, 2013, as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series.
Among all of Hannah Arendt's writings, Eichmann in Jerusalem generated by far the most acrimonious and tangled controversy, which has since cast a long shadow on her eventful but otherwise respectable and illustrious career as a public intellectual and as an academic. The Eichmann affair raised a host of questions about Arendt, not only as a political thinker, but as an individual Jew. Gershom Scholem's cruel phrase that Arendt lacked Ahavat Israel, love of the Jewish people, captures this collective bitterness. A letter to Mary McCarthy of October 1963 hints at Arendt's state of mind when writing this work. I'm quoting, "You were the only reader to understand what otherwise I have never admitted, namely, that I wrote this book in a curious state of euphoria, and that ever since I did, I feel, after 20 years since the war, lighthearted about the whole matter. Don't tell anybody. Is it not proof positive that I have no soul?" End of quote. The use of the term lighthearted, like the phrase the banality of evil, is a terminological infelicity. Arendt did not mean that she was joyful or carefree about the whole matter. She meant rather that her heart was lightened by having shed a burden. By voicing in public the shame, rage, and sadness she had carried in private for 30 years, she was finally unloading some of the burden history had imposed upon her. Arendt had written about totalitarianism, anti-Semitism, the extermination camps, the Nazi death machinery before. What was unprecedented in the Eichmann affair was that for the first time a struggle broke out among the Jewish community and the survivors of the Holocaust over how and in what terms to appropriate the memory of the Holocaust and its victims. In writing Eichmann in Jerusalem, Arendt could not capture the lyrical and almost elegiac beauty of the loss of home and world expressed in her early article, We Refugees. The question of narrative voice, which had so preoccupied her during the time in which she wrote The Origins of Totalitarianism, abandoned her in Eichmann in Jerusalem. The unwieldiness of the narrative she tried to hold together in Eichmann in Jerusalem, as well as the existential closeness of the subject matter to her, gave rise to a work that still leaves one at times breathless, at others puzzled, baffled, and irritated. Now, just a statement of the facts of Eichmann's capture. On May 11, 1960, members of the Israeli Secret Service kidnapped the Nazi fugitive Adolf Eichmann in Argentina, spiriting him out of the country so he could stand trial in Israel for crimes he had committed in the course, quote, of the final solution. Eichmann's main responsibility during the Holocaust had been the organization of the transport of millions of Jews from across Europe to the concentration and death camps. He was the head of the so-called section 4B4, 4B4, a function he had carried out with zeal and efficiency. After the war, he escaped to Argentina, where he lived an anonymous life, although his presence was known to the authorities. After a fruitless quarrel over his extradition with the Argentine government, the Israelis dramatically took the matter into their own hands, Once Eichmann was safely in Israel, they mounted a riveting and very public trial, one goal of which was to bring attention to what Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion called the most tragic episode in our history, the most tragic facts in world history, end of quote. From the beginning then, the Israelis saw the trial of Eichmann as serving a dual function. First and most obviously, Eichmann was to be brought to justice for the crimes against humanity he had committed in helping to implement the Nazis' final solution to the so-called Jewish question. Second, and almost equally important from the Israeli point of view, was the education of public opinion in Israel and the rest of the world about the nature and extent of Nazi extermination of European Jewry. The enormity of the crime was known, sort of known, actually, in 1963. But until the Eichmann trial, there had been relatively little public discussion of the legal, moral, and political dimensions of the genocide, which I think is hard for us now, in 50 years after this, to understand what was known and what was not known in 1963. The Nuremberg trials had set a precedent for the legal consideration of crimes against humanity, but they had treated the administrative murder of millions of Jews, as it was called, as but one item in the long list of outrages committed during the war by a criminal regime. When Hannah Arendt heard that the Israelis intended to try Eichmann in Israel, she immediately proposed herself as a trial reporter to the editor of The New Yorker, William Schoen. He accepted, and Arendt found herself attending Eichmann's trial in Jerusalem, the main part of which lasted from April 11th to August 14th, 1961. She was taken aback by what she later described as the sheer ordinariness of the man who had been party to such enormous crimes. Eichmann spoke in endless clichés, gave little evidence of being motivated by a fanatical hatred of the Jews, and was most proud of being, quote, a law-abiding citizen. It was the shock of seeing Eichmann in the flesh that led Arendt to the thought that great wickedness was not a necessary condition for the performance of or complicity in great crimes. Evil could take a banal form, as it had in Eichmann. However, an ordinary Eichmann did not fit the role of the prosecution in the case led by Gideon Hausner, what Gideon Hausner had in mind. Gideon Hausner presented a diabolical and fanatical Eichmann, inflating his actual crimes into a near comprehensive responsibility for the Holocaust. That Arendt had little patience for the prosecution's exaggeration of Eichmann's role and personal brutality is amply attested in the pages of Eichmann in Jerusalem, as is her disdain for what she viewed as Gideon Hausner's courtroom dramatics. The sarcasm Arendt directed at him and the prosecution in the case alienated many readers of the original New Yorker articles published in early 1963, as did her suggestion that some members of the Jewish councils had been unwitting collaborators insofar as they had supplied the Nazis with lists of their fellow Jews who were to be deported. On December 11, 1961, after a four-month recess, the three-judge panel hearing the case in Jerusalem reconvened to pronounce judgment. Adolf Eichmann was found guilty of committing crimes against the Jewish people with the intent to destroy it. He was sentenced to death and hanged. Arendt's trial report appeared as a book in the spring of 1963. The controversy which has embroiled it preceded its publication and continues in some quarters until today. Now, there are at least three socio-historical narratives in Eichmann in Jerusalem, each of which could have been the subject of separate volumes. First is Arendt's reporting of the circumstances of Eichmann's arrest, detention, and the trial by the Israeli authorities, including the behavior of Chief Prosecutor Gideon Hausner. Second is the account of the role of the Jewish councils, the Judenräte, The special committees appointed by the Nazis with a decree of September 21, 1939, in the administration of the Jewish populations of Poland, the Baltic countries, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and the occupied regions of the USSR, such as Belarus and Ukraine, and the actions and cooperation of the Judenräte with the Nazis in carrying out the final solution. Third is her attempt to come to grips with the behavior of so-called ordinary German citizens and the moral questions or questions in moral philosophy that this gives rise to. Now, what I will do first is I will begin by focusing on the controversy about the status of the Jewish councils. Of all the thorny historical and moral issues touched upon by Hannah Arendt in this book, her evaluation of the behavior of the Jewish councils remains the most difficult one, and this is what was so hurtful to the Jewish community. It was also her passing judgment on these events and the individuals involved in them that earned her the wrath, rejection, and condemnation of established Jewry. To be sure, Arendt should have distinguished more carefully among the various stages of the silent cooperation between the Nazi regime and the Jewish organizations and committees, something referred to as Havurot in English, in Hebrew. But before 1936, according to historical records that are now well established, there was some collaboration between the Gestapo and Zionist organizations, which shared, in the words of one historian, a negative identity of aims, in that each, albeit in different ways, wanted the Jewish population to leave Germany and other European territories. Until 1938, the Central Committee of German Citizens of Jewish Faith retained the hope of being able to find some modus vivendi with the regime. Arendt had initially used the term der jüdische Führer, the Jewish Führer, to describe the activities of Leo Beck, the former chief rabbi of Berlin, a terminology that she later dropped in the book. Arendt was concerned about the role of the Jewish councils from the very beginning of the Eichmann controversy. She wrote to her teacher and mentor, Karl Jaspers, on December 23, 1960, quote, "I'm afraid that Eichmann will be able to prove, first of all, that no country wanted the Jews, just the kind of Zionist propaganda," she adds, "which Ben-Gurion wants and that I consider a disaster. And Eichmann will demonstrate, second, to what a huge degree the Jews helped organize their own destruction." That is, of course, the naked truth. But this truth, if it is not really explained, could stir up more anti-Semitism than 10 kidnappings.
Shayla Ben-Habib, speaking about the book Eichmann in Jerusalem. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on October 24th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Shayla Ben-Habib in a moment. 920 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow morning, we are going to review the week's news with Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, and Luke Burbank, host of LiveWire. That'll be tomorrow morning at 10. Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, offering a selection of game day food in the PCC Deli, including take-and-bake pizzas and dips and spreads, with 9 neighborhood locations. More at pccnaturalmarkets.com. Support for KUOW comes from Puget Sound Blood Center, now celebrating 70 years of community service and thanking dedicated blood donors, volunteers, and contributors. Information at psbc.org/impact. Puget Sound Blood Center, saving lives every day.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Adolf Eichmann was one of the major facilitators of the Holocaust. He organized the deportation of thousands of Jews to ghettos and extermination camps. After the war, Eichmann fled to Argentina, but was ultimately captured and tried for war crimes. The trial was the subject of the book Eichmann in Jerusalem by Hannah Arendt. Arendt was a Jew who fled Germany in the early 1930s. In the book, she refers to Eichmann's actions as the banality of evil. She believed he was a sane person who thought his actions were normal. Yale professor Shayla Ben-Habib offers an overview of the controversy surrounding Arendt's book. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on October 24, 2013, as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series.
Hannah Arendt had left Germany in 1933 because she was collecting material for her friend Kurt Blumenfeld, who plays such an important role in the movie, for those of you who have seen it. Because she was collecting material for Kurt Blumenfeld on German professional organizations and business associations which were beginning to take punitive action against their Jewish members. Blumenfeld would in turn present this material at the 18th Zionist Congress in 1933. She was arrested by the Gestapo and briefly detained, and subsequently left Germany. After coming to Paris, she worked for an Aliyah organization which was settling children in Palestine. In New York, she wrote on Jewish issues for the Yiddish periodical Der Aufbau. Noteworthy in this context is her call for a Jewish army to fight against the Nazis in cooperation with Allied forces. After the establishment of the State of Israel, and particularly after the failure of Yehuda Magnus's efforts for establishing a binational democratic federation in Palestine, and the hostility towards this view expressed by American Jews, she was booed once she gave a speech on this question in Connecticut. Arendt fell silent on the Jewish question. Her Eichmann book sent her back to the memories of a past in which she had been not only a persecuted and stateless Jew, but a political militant and left-thinking Zionist who was very much part of the milieu of European socialist and communist sympathizers, fighters, and organizers. Let me say a few words about this milieu, this background. Part of the tragedy behind Arendt's report on the Eichmann trial is the passing away of the memory of this historical milieu, which in the 1920s and 1930s brought into contact Bundists who wanted to build a Jewish entity as part of the Federated Soviet Socialist Republics, National Zionists who wanted a separate Jewish state in Palestine, labor Zionists who thought the dream of socialism could only be realized in a Jewish state, and communist militants, Jewish and non-Jewish, who fought in the International Brigade in Spain. Of these last, some were subsequently murdered by Stalin, and a number found their way in Palestine. Although she was not a militant herself, Hannah Arendt was molded by the dreams and hopes of this political milieu, this other Europe, which she then saw realized in the French resistance to the Nazis after 1941. Many of her judgments about the behavior of established Jewish organizations during the Holocaust expressed the standpoint of a Jewish political militancy, which ironically at times brought her into the company of the militant Zionist revisionist leader Zev Jabotinsky and his group within the Zionist movement. They tried to establish a group in New York called the Jüdische Gruppe or something, and she goes to a meeting and she discovers that these are people affiliated with Jabotinsky. It's very interesting. Emerging out of this background, Hannah Arendt had a much more differentiated and nuanced judgment of the behavior of individual Germans and Jews during the Nazi regime. For her, generalizations about German national character, inherent German anti-Semitism, and so on, would have been impossible, precisely because as one who had lived through this period, she had a sense of individual choices, biographies, and commitments, all of which indicated for her it could have been otherwise. The case of Sergeant Anton Schmidt, who helped Jewish partisans by supplying them with forged papers and military trucks until he was arrested and executed, movingly exemplified for Arendt this possibility, this other Europe. With reference to Schmidt, Arendt writes in Eichmann in Jerusalem, I'm quoting, "And in those 2 minutes, which were like a sudden burst of light in the midst of the impenetrable unfathomable darkness, a single thought stood out clearly, irrefutably, beyond question. How utterly different everything would be today in this courtroom, in Israel, in Germany, in all of Europe, and perhaps in all countries of the world, if only more such stories could have been told. End of quote. In the last pages of The Origins of Totalitarianism, Hannah Arendt had written of the Holocaust, and in particular of the extermination camps, as the appearance of the radical evil on earth. This term, which originates in Kant's Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone, was subsequently dropped by Arendt. Writing the Eichmann book, she says, was a cura posterior, a posterior cure for her. Exactly why, this is harder to explain. For Hannah Arendt did not give up her claim that with the establishment of concentration and death camps, some radical evil, these are her words, previously unknown to us, had occurred. What had occurred defied all hitherto known standards and confronted us with the realization, again I'm quoting, that something seems to be involved in modern politics that actually should never be involved in politics as we used to understand it, end of quote. Arendt insists at the end of Eichmann in Jerusalem that, quote, every act that has once made its appearance and has been recorded in the history of mankind stays with mankind as a potentiality long after its actuality has become a thing of the past. That the unprecedented, once it has appeared, may become a precedent for the future, that all trials touching upon crimes against humanity must be judged, therefore, according to a standard that is today still an ideal, end of quote. Arendt changed none of her views on these questions in Eichmann in Jerusalem. But the phraseology of the banality of evil and thoughtlessness, which she used to describe Eichmann's deeds, was greatly misleading. Arendt forced the English language into a Procrustean bed to convey her own complex and even ultimately inconclusive reflections on the question of personal responsibility under dictatorship and thinking and moral judgment. She did not mean that what Eichmann had helped to perpetrate was banal, or that the extermination of the Jews and of other peoples by the Nazis was banal. It takes either a great deal of hermeneutic blindness and ill will, or both, to miss her meaning in the usage of the term, even if one may disagree with the assessment of Eichmann's psychology. There's an interesting set of comments by Karl Jaspers in a letter to Arendt of December 13, 1963. And Karl Jaspers writes, Al Copley, a common friend from New York, told me that Heinrich Blücher suggested the phrase, Heinrich Blücher is her husband, the banality of evil, and is cursing himself for it now because you've had to take the heat for what he thought of. Perhaps the report isn't true, or my recollection of it is garbled. I think it's a wonderful inspiration and right on the mark as the book's subtitle. The point is that this evil, not evil per se, is banal. Whatever the origins of the term, let's stay with this, whatever the origins of this term, whether invented by Arendt or Blücher or even Jaspers himself, Arendt's views on evil were of quite a different nature than what was commonly associated with this term in Western thought. The phrase, the banality of evil, was meant to refer to a specific quality of mind and character of the doer himself, but neither to the deeds nor to the principle behind these deeds. Rereading Eichmann in Jerusalem, one can feel Arendt's bafflement at Eichmann's persona and conduct before and during the trial. Writing in the postscript that she would have welcomed a general discussion of the concept of the banality of evil, she continues, Eichmann was not Iago and not Macbeth. And nothing would have been farther from his mind than to determine with Richard III to prove a villain. He merely, to put the matter colloquially, never realized what he was doing. It was precisely this lack of imagination which enabled him to sit for months on end facing a German Jew who was conducting the police interrogation. Sorry, I don't have the whole quote here. It was sheer thoughtlessness, something by no means identical with stupidity, that predisposed him to become one of the greatest criminals of that period. That such remoteness from reality and such thoughtlessness can wreak more havoc than all the evil instincts taken together, which perhaps are inherent in man, that was, in fact, the lesson one could learn in Jerusalem. To solve, or more correctly, to think through the philosophical problem of moral judgment which this trial had raised in all its urgency, Arendt would turn in the years to come again and again to Kant's moral and political philosophy. These deep perplexities of moral philosophy about thinking, judging, and moral action were what really preoccupied Arendt in her attempt to analyze Eichmann. Precisely because she herself had not resolved some of these puzzles, the wider public found it difficult to grasp what she was after. The phrase, the banality of evil, was, I believe, quite secondary to Arendt's preoccupations with these moral issues. Now, in using the phrase, the banality of evil, and in explaining the moral quality of Eichmann's deeds, not in terms of the monstrous or demonic nature of the doer, Arendt became aware of going against the tradition which saw evil in metaphysical terms as ultimate depravity, corruption, or sinfulness. The most striking quality of Eichmann, she claimed, was not stupidity, wickedness, or depravity, but one she described as thoughtlessness. Again, thoughtlessness in English is, you know, just like not being considerate, and it's so far from what she's trying to express, you know, and she keeps pushing the limits of language in this book, which is what makes it so difficult, I think, for the general public. Now, this question then, in turn, led her to ask, might the problem of good and evil, our faculty for telling right from wrong, be connected with our faculty of thought? Could the activity of thinking as such, the habit of examining whatever happens to come to pass or attract attention, regardless of results and specific contents, could this activity be among the conditions that make man abstain from evil doing or even actually condition them against it? It's from the Life of the Mind. She asked, is our ability to judge, to tell right from wrong, beautiful from ugly, dependent upon our faculty of thought? Do the inability to think and the disastrous failure of what we commonly call conscience coincide? That these issues in moral philosophy lay behind her ill-chosen phrase of the banality of evil is also evidenced by her correspondence with Mary McCarthy. On August 10, 1945, McCarthy wrote to Arendt with a philosophical query. And you know again from the movie how close they were as friends. McCarthy had been pondering Raskolnikov's old problem in Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. Why shouldn't I murder my grandmother if I want to? Give me one good reason, she writes. Arendt responds with a professorial gesture which acknowledges the depth as well as the difficulty of McCarthy's question. The philosophic answer would be the answer of Socrates. Since I have to live with myself, am in fact the only person from whom I shall never be able to part, whose company I shall have to bear forever, I don't want to become a murderer. I don't want to spend my life in the company of a murderer, namely me. McCarthy is unconvinced. The modern person, I posit, would say to Socrates with a shrug, why not? What's wrong with a murderer? And Socrates would be back where he started, end of quote. Thinker of Whitman, do I contradict myself? So do I contain the multitudes. The Eichmann affair showed the centrality of moral and political judgment for human life in many and varied ways. There was the retrospective judgment which every historian and narrator of past events had to exercise. There was the moral judgment of contemporaries who stood in judgment over Eichmann and his actions. There was also the lack of a faculty of judgment on Eichmann's part. Even in her subsequent reflections on these questions, Arendt could not integrate all these aspects of judging into a coherent account and resolve the issues in moral philosophy which this trial had posed for her. Now, I'm just going to say something here very briefly before I address the final issue, Crimes Against Humanity. There is a new and important historical book by a German historian, Barbara Stangnes, called Eichmann for Jerusalem, Eichmann before Jerusalem. This indicates that Arendt was not and could not be fully aware of all the activities that Eichmann was engaged in with a rather thick circle of ex-Nazis in Argentina. The best known of them is a journalist called Sassen, Wilhelm Sassen, to whom actually Eichmann had started dictating a version of his autobiography. Okay? And he wanted, in fact, to speak, he, Adolf Eichmann, in his own voice. The reason why I'm just mentioning this now is because, in my own view, this new evidence does not affect the central philosophical questions, but this is a 650-page book in German, which many of us are still pondering. So in the name of scholarly honesty, I want to mention to you that there is this new discussion that is sort of unfolding. My own judgment of it yet is that it's not going to really radically alter Arendt's questions, which, as I'm trying to suggest, are not solely centered on Eichmann's personality.
Shayla Ben Habib, speaking about the book Eichmann in Jerusalem. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on October 24th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Shayla Ben Habib in a moment, 939, 94.9, KUOW. Computer systems specialist Joshua Klein starts his latest book with the question, "How much is your mother worth?" The name of the book is Reputation Economics, Why Who You Know is Worth More Than What You Have. We'll talk with him about it tomorrow during the noon hour. Lows lower to mid-40s tonight for the Seattle area. Rain turning to showers and becoming windy. Friday highs around 50. Cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning and breezy. Rain developing in the afternoon. Vocalist, pianist, and composer John Prue, who's performed with Natalie Cole, Anita O'Day, and Marion McPartland, will be Michael Feinstein's guest starting in a few minutes at 10 o'clock. On Song Travels. Support for KUOW comes from Women's Therapy Referral Service. For more than 35 years, helping people find the right therapist through personalized matching and in-person consultation. Details online at therapyreferral.org. Support for KUOW comes from UC Berkeley's Berkeley MBA for Executives and the Evening and Weekend MBA programs, offering two part-time MBA programs for working professionals. Seattle Information Session on January 14th at the Renaissance Seattle Hotel, haas.berkeley.edu.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. In 1963, one of the most controversial books of the 20th century was published. Eichmann in Jerusalem presented Adolf Eichmann not as a sociopath, but as an ordinary person who simply believed his actions were normal. The author of this book, political theorist Hannah Arendt, refers to this theory as the banality of evil. Arendt was a Jew who fled Germany in the early 1930s. Yale professor Shayla Ben Habib offers an overview of the controversy surrounding Arendt's book and what lessons it can teach us about humanity. Ben Habib spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on October 24, 2013, as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series.
After Eichmann's kidnapping in Argentina by the Israeli Secret Service on May 11, 1960, both Karl Jaspers and Hannah Arendt were anguished about the illegality of this act and about the moral and legal issues involved in his being tried by an Israeli court. Arendt was convinced to the very end that the state of Israel had committed, quote, a clear violation of international law in order to bring Eichmann to justice. She also notes that what enabled Israel to get away with this international in the world community was Eichmann's de facto statelessness, that neither post-war Argentina nor Germany were to claim him as their citizen. Inasmuch as she questioned the justifiability of the circumstances surrounding Eichmann's capture, Arendt did not differ from Jaspers. Yet while Jaspers wanted Israel to hand over the jurisdiction of the trial to an international court or body, Arendt defended Israel's right to bring Eichmann to trial and pass judgment on him. There were three kinds of objections raised to the trial. First, there was the objection also voiced in the case of the Nuremberg trials as well, that Eichmann was tried under a retroactive law and appeared in the court of the victors, the problem of retroactivity. Arendt thought that the Israeli court's reply to this objection was justifiable. The Nuremberg trials were cited in Jerusalem court as precedent, and the Nazi collaboration punishment law of 1950 in Israel was based on this precedent. Her observations on this principle, nullum crimen, nulla poena sine lege, there is no crime nor wrongdoing without the law, are interesting. She observes that the principle of retroactivity, that no one can be condemned for an act that was not against the law at the time it was committed, is only meaningful if it applies to an act known to the legislator. If a previously unknown crime, she argues, makes its appearance in human history, such as the crime of genocide perpetrated during the Holocaust, justice in this instance demands a new and unprecedented law. The Eichmann trial did not violate this principle of retroactivity, she claims. The Nuremberg trials had established such a law through the Charter, the London Agreement of 1945, and Israel invoked its own law against genocide, which was in turn based on the Nuremberg Charter. Arendt was not therefore particularly concerned with the argument that the justice meted out at the Nuremberg trials, as well as the case of Eichmann, was the justice of the victor, Siegerjustiz, since she held to the view that the crimes perpetrated by the Nazis were of such an unprecedented nature that one needed new categories, such as crimes against humanity, to judge them. Now, to the second objection, that the court in Israel was not competent to try Eichmann, Arendt gave a more equivocal answer, for this issue concerned the state of Israel's right to represent and speak in the name of all the victims of Adolf Eichmann. Arendt is firm that insofar as Eichmann had participated in the killing of Jews before, because they were Jews, and not because they were Poles, Lithuanians, Romanians, a Jewish political entity could represent the victims. The basis on which Israel could do so, she maintained, could be made consistent with the Genocide Convention adopted by the UN General Assembly in 1948, which provided, quote, that the person charged with genocide shall be tried by a competent tribunal of the states in the territory of which the act was committed, or by such an international penal tribunal as may have jurisdiction, end of quote. And since there were many Holocaust survivors who were in the state of Israel, Arendt really thought that Israel could assume this function of representativity. Now, the third category, namely crimes against humanity, is what most captures Arendt's attention. And it is here that she criticizes the sentence of the Israeli court. In particular, she was critical of the use of the category of crimes against humanity by the Israeli court. This is a bit complicated, but bear with me. Quote, to include genocide if practiced against non-Jewish peoples, such as the Gypsies or the Poles, and all other crimes, including murder, committed against either Jews or non-Jews, provided that these crimes were not committed with intent to destroy the people as a whole, end of quote. The Israeli court made a crucial distinction between crimes against the Jewish people and crimes against humanity. And this is what Arendt thought was categorically wrong and missed the whole point of crimes against humanity. For her, this was based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the category. The unprecedented category of crimes against humanity was invented, she insisted, precisely to name a new kind of act, namely, the act of genocide which was perpetrated against a people simply because it existed on the face of this earth as this specific kind of people, as exemplifying one ways of being among many possible modes of human diversity. Jews had been killed, she argued, not because they were enemies of the regime, class traitors, spies against the Führer, but because, qua Jews, they were said to be certain kinds of beings that had no right to be on this earth. Genocide requires some form of race thinking as its basis, because it aims at the elimination of a people in virtue of its collective characteristics, which it's construed as possessing. And Arendt then observes, had the court in Jerusalem understood that there were distinctions between discrimination, expulsion, and genocide, it would immediately have become clear that the supreme crime it was confronted with, the physical extermination of the Jewish people, was a crime against humanity perpetrated upon the body of the Jewish people, and that only the choice of victims, not the nature of the crime, could be derived from the long history of Jew hatred and anti-Semitism. Insofar as the victims were Jews, it was right and proper that a Jewish court could sit in judgment. But insofar as the crime was a crime against humanity, it needed an international tribunal to do justice to it. Hannah Arendt, we might say, wanted finally to reconcile the universal and the particular, the ideal of humanity, and the fact of human particularity and diversity. The concept of crimes against humanity immediately invokes the concept of the right to have rights, discussed in The Origins of Totalitarianism. In virtue of our humanity alone, Arendt is arguing we are beings entitled to be treated in certain ways, and when such treatment is not accorded to us, then both wrongs and crimes are committed against us. Of course, Arendt was thinking along Kantian lines that we are moral persons and that our humanity and our moral personality coexist. Yet these are not the terms that she will use, nor will she, like Kant, seek to ground the mutual obligation we owe one another in our capacity for acting in accordance with the principles of reason. Even her formula, the right to have rights, is frustratingly ambiguous. If we have a right to have rights, who could deprive us of it? If we do not already have such a right, how can we acquire it? Furthermore, what is meant by a right in this formula, a legally recognized claim or a moral claim which we, qua members of a human group, address to our fellow human beings to be recognized as their equals? And these questions will be addressed in my colloquium tomorrow in the philosophy department. I promise I will attempt. The Eichmann trial was a watershed of sorts because it brought to the fore the contradictions with which she had struggled and with existentially and conceptually all her life. Now, in conclusion, I want to engage in some brief and maybe to you surprising reflections on the banality of evil or the use of the term evil as is occurring in contemporary American culture. I will come back to Arendt. It is clear that Arendt's central thesis, that neither particularly evil nor particularly demonic individuals can perform such acts, still disturbs and haunts us. Our culture is in fact awash in the language of evil. Thus, during the third week of September, the New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd quoted Dr. Janice Orlovsky, the chief operating officer of MedStar Washington Hospital Center, with respect to the shootings in the Navy Yard earlier that week, as saying, quote, there is something evil in our society that we as Americans have to work to try to eradicate. There's something wrong here. When we have these multiple shootings, these multiple injuries, there is something wrong. 3 days before Maureen Dowd's editorial, Peter Ludlow, a professor of philosophy at Northwestern University, published a piece called The Banality of Systemic Evil. Some of you may have read this in the Opinionator in the New York Times blog site. Citing Eichmann in Jerusalem, Ludlow argued that one interpretation of the banality of evil is that it is, quote, a statement about what happens when people play their proper roles within the system, following prescribed conduct with respect to that system while remaining blind to the consequences of what the system was doing, or at least compartmentalizing and ignoring these consequences, end of quote. Ludlow presents Edward Snowden, Jeremy Hammond, Aaron Swartz, and Chelsea Manning, formerly known as Bradley Manning, as the anti-Eichmanns of our times, as intrepid young people who resisted systemic evil of military secrecy, data mining, and closed source resources. Within a few hours, Ludlow's piece garnered 700-odd comments and was the fifth most emailed article of the New York Times that day. There is an understandable desire in the uses of the term evil and the banality of evil in this quotidian census. As our psyches are bludgeoned by image after image of the senseless deaths of schoolchildren, of office workers, of military personnel, of moviegoers, like Dr. Orlovsky, we feel that something is deeply sick in contemporary American society. Nor is it wrong for Ludlow to morally defend the young people resisting the new system of web secrecy and violations of privacy by honoring them as defying systemic evil. Yet we know that neither the senseless mass murder of anonymous individuals nor resisting administrative and bureaucratic illegality and constitutional overreach are what aren't meant by the banality of evil. She distinguished carefully between administrative massacres and genocide, and argued that genocide portrays a plurality and is a crime against the human condition as such. In the dramatic epilogue to Eichmann in Jerusalem, she states that the justice of what was done in Jerusalem could have emerged to be seen by all if the judges had dared to address their defendant in something like the following terms. And in astonishingly pointed language, she delivers her own verdict against Adolf Eichmann. I quote, "You admitted that the crime committed against the Jewish people during the war was the greatest crime in recorded history, and you admitted your role in it. Let us assume for the sake of argument that it was nothing more than misfortune that made you a willing instrument in the organization of mass murder. There still remains the fact that you have carried out and therefore actively supported a policy of mass murder. And just as you supported and carried out a policy of not wanting to share the earth with the Jewish people and the people of a number of other nations, as though you and your superiors had any right to determine who should and should not inhabit the world, we find that no one, that is, no member of the human race, can be expected to share the earth with you. This is the reason and only reason you must hang." Now, if you read this passage carefully, one can also conclude the opposite. The astonishing transformation of voice, with Arendt assuming the role of the judges of Israel to deliver her own verdict on Eichmann, has been noted by many, and I will not comment on it here, and also the logically fallacious conclusion that if what Eichmann is being convicted of is not wanting to share the earth with people of a certain kind, then why should the death decision against them be morally justifiable? You could, you know, draw the opposite conclusion, right? Most recently, Judith Butler has asked, is the final verdict that Arendt delivers then something other than vengeance? I think it is. As early as June to September 1950, we see from her notes in the Denktage Bücher, which are her notes now, intellectual notes in two volumes that have come out, that Arendt is preoccupied with forgiveness, reconciliation, and revenge. She writes of a fundamental gratefulness for all that is given, an attitude which is distinct from reconciling oneself with whatever happens to occur. This fundamental gratefulness inframes the human condition, but the life of politics, the life of plurality, unfolds as the pendulum swings between reconciliation and forgiveness. Only equals can forgive one another, according to Arendt. Reconciliation assumes that one who is wrong takes onto himself the wrong that the other has committed and releases the other of the burden of guilt. But there is and can be no reconciliation between Arendt, who now speaks as a member of the Jewish people, and Eichmann. But neither is punishing him revenge, because paradoxically, punishment means treating him as an equal who violated the human order of equality by joining a government that sought to eliminate human plurality from earth. It is these philosophical theses that lead Arendt to criticize the judgment of the judges of Israel and not some hidden resentment of a self-hating Jew or some other ethnocentric prejudice against the so-called Ostjuden. What should we do then in view of the widespread use of the term evil and also the banality of evil in the contemporary world? I think we need to understand that these terms are most generally invoked when human beings encounter some sense of limit that has been transgressed by the actions of others, a transgression which in its senselessness threatens to render the shared world incomprehensible. There is no moral calculus or theological homily that can render the Sandy Hook elementary school massacres comprehensible, ever. Yet just as Arendt sat there, observing in dumbfounded fashion the nervous tick on the cheek of Adolf Eichmann that made his flesh twitch, and the absolute banality of his language, we have to try to understand Adam Lanza. We have to construct the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooter. We have to construct a narrative which can never ever culminate in the necessity of what he did, but nevertheless, we need to extend the limits of our moral imagination to understand his suffering, his loneliness, and his banality in the basement of his wealthy Connecticut home as he sat there hours on end playing with his video games. I think Arendt understood that to save the world we share and to cherish human plurality, we must be ready to force the limits of moral imagination. That to call Eichmann diabolical, the chief anti-Semite, was simply too easy, because he was not diabolical. He was shrewd, but he was no Mephisto. By calling him diabolical, many were in fact releasing him from the boundaries of our shared world. And this Arendt did not want to do. For Arendt, and the trial of Adolf Eichmann was in the end not about Eichmann, but it was about preserving the fragile limits of our shared world. Thank you for listening.
Shayla Ben-Habib, speaking about the book Eichmann in Jerusalem. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on October 24th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. And you can follow us on Twitter at @KUOWSpeakers. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Swedish, announcing the opening of their health insurance information desk for those who have questions about which new health plans in Washington include Swedish in their provider networks. More information at swedish.org.
Hi, I'm Marcy Silman. Thank you to everyone who made a gift and became a member of KUOW in 2013. Your generosity sustains our intelligent news, information, and cultural programming all year long. On behalf of everyone here at KUOW, thank you.
10 o'clock, KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham. I'm Bill O'Grady.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.